From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. According to the Chinese government, more than 20 people have died this month during protests in Tibet. According to Tibetan exiles, nearly 140 lost their lives. It's been hard for Western reporters to get a firm grip on the numbers or even the players. Jeremy Goldcorn is the founder and director of DonWei.org, a media analysis site based in Beijing. He says that both East and West have fallen into an information gap.
The two views are pretty extreme. On the one hand, you have the hippie, smiling, peaceful Buddhist monks. That tends to be the perception in the West. And in China, for most Han Chinese people, which is most of the country, they tend to think of Tibet as a brutal, feudal country that was liberated by the Communist Party from its feudal shackles and then has had a great deal of investment. I don't mean here to, you know, defend anything the Chinese government has done in Tibet particularly, but I do think what is missing from the reportage is nuance. I think the situation is not as clear-cut as it can seem for various reasons, you know, mostly to do with the Chinese government's own issues. It's very difficult to get information from Tibet. There are not a lot of journalists there. There are not a lot of research organizations. NGOs have a tough time to operate. Because of this, it's very difficult to get information about Tibet that does not come from either the propaganda machine in Beijing or the propaganda machine coming out of the Tibetan government in exile in Dharamsala.
Whether the West is entirely right or partly wrong, the pictures of protesting monks are starting to have Olympic-sized ramifications. This was not anticipated by the insular Chinese when it won the Games, and it comes as a shock even now, complicated by China's close financial ties with Sudan, which human rights activists say abets the genocide in Darfur. An organization called Dream for Darfur is trying to save lives by branding the Beijing Games the Genocide Olympics. The group wants China to use its ties with Sudan to pressure the country into allowing peacekeepers into Darfur. But Genocide Olympics is a hard sell, and Executive Director Jill Savitt says that Dream for Darfur launched its campaign last summer much more gently.
We decided to start with a more polite approach and to ask nicely. Throughout the campaign, we've targeted a lot of different stakeholders in the Olympics, and we've always tried to start by giving folks an opportunity to do the right thing.
One of your early mottos was, bring the Olympic dream to Darfur.
Yes, it was prefaced by, China, please bring the Olympic dream to Darfur. So we really were committed to asking nicely, but also in a campaign, you don't give yourself anywhere to go rhetorically if you start at Genocide Olympics.
But you're there now. How did you get there?
Well, we were always going to go there. It's actually a term created by a Washington Post editorial writer who did an editorial in December of 2007 called Genocide Olympics.
And yet you credit Nick Kristof of the New York Times for applying it to you.
Yeah, he did a column in January, and it was a little before we had anticipated using the term ourselves. And in the column, he called us the Genocide Olympics campaign and gave our web address. It prompted us to move a little more quickly, which is a bit funny because we've been using the media as a prod for a lot of our targets, and then we also were prodded.
And you've compared your strategy to a presidential campaign.
What we did at the very beginning was made a list of all the Olympic stakeholders. So there was athletes, the corporate sponsors, the International Olympic Committee, and the National Olympic Committee, which is the United States Olympic Committee. And then, of course, there were policymakers and the media, and we had a specific strategy for reaching out to each one. There's going to be the official torch coming to the United States on April 9th in San Francisco. So there'll be a whole bunch of T-shirts and placards and actually billboard trucks associated with that. At other Olympic torch relay events, one might see a helicopter being trailed by a banner with the message on it. So that's how it's like, I think, a political campaign. We were created for one purpose, which was to use the Olympic Games as leverage to change China's policy on Darfur. And we will disband after the Olympics.
Are you worried about the fact that the Olympics already has a brand, a pretty positive one, that you're sullying up with your message of death and genocide?
Well, I would make the argument that we're trying to save the Olympics, and it's Beijing that's sullying the Games. We believe in the Olympics. We are staunchly anti-boycott. In fact, we're committed multilateralists who believe that the Olympics is perhaps one of the last international events and forums that people still like. It's China that is hypocritical in this regard, because they are using the Olympics as a propaganda campaign at the same time that they are underwriting a genocide.
How is it going? Do you think the branding is working? Are people putting Olympics and genocide together in the way that you would like them to?
Well, I do think so. When we started out, we knew we had an uphill battle in saying somehow that the Olympics and China were related to Darfur, when so many people didn't even know where Darfur was. So I do think we have made this association and it has stuck. But to be very frank with you, that's not our goal. Our goal is not to build equity in this brand. It's to get security on the ground in Darfur. And in that regard, I have to sadly admit that we're not succeeding.
Jill, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Jill Savitt is the executive director of Dream for Darfur, profiled in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. When the modern Olympics began in 1896, its image was supposed to be one of international unity. But as the reach of the media grew, so has the appeal of the Olympics as political theater, which usually takes the form of protests and tit-for-tat boycotts. David Walachinsky is an Olympics historian. He says politics has played a role at the Olympics ever since the 1936 Berlin Games, when photos, newsreels, radio, print, and even early closed-circuit TV put the Olympics front and center and gave Hitler a shot at the gold.
The Nazis were the first to realize that this was a stage to make a statement. And in the case of Korean marathon runners who protested that they had to compete using Japanese names and Japanese flags, it was also their chance to make a statement in the international arena, which they could not do back at home. So this was really, 1936 was the beginning of media Olympics.
And what about Jesse Owens?
What was interesting was that the Nazis, with their Aryan ideology, criticized the Americans as bringing black auxiliaries to represent them, including Jesse Owens. It didn't really work for them because Jesse Owens was a fantastic athlete. He was actually the hero of the people of Berlin. Everybody wanted his autograph. There was a famous incident where Jesse Owens competed against Lutz Long, the German champion in the long jump, what was then called the broad jump. Lutz Long went out of his way to be photographed with Jesse Owens in the stadium by the international press, which was a real slap in the face of the Nazi party.
So, jam-packed with symbolism before and during and ever after, how conscious was the Olympic Organizing Committee in 1936 about the image of the Olympics as a brand?
Back then, before World War II, there wasn't really that sense of the Olympics being a brand. The International Olympic Committee was quite an elite organization. You only had rich white men. They lived in quite a rarefied world. So they didn't really think of the Olympics as a brand. It was just kind of their country club.
That changed in 1968.
That's right. Through 1960, all the Olympic Games had been hosted either by European nations or by the United States. And the International Olympic Committee suddenly realized, well, there's the rest of the world out there. So they awarded the 1964 Games to Tokyo. And then in 1968, you saw the first real third world country, at least at that time, hosting the Games, which was Mexico City. This led to a very disturbing incident 10 days before the opening ceremonies. The Mexican military killed approximately 250 people, nonviolent protesters, on the streets of Mexico City. The International Olympic Committee took the position that this was a domestic issue and that they shouldn't say anything about it and it shouldn't have any effect on the Olympics going ahead. Yet a couple weeks later, two American athletes, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, staged a silent, nonviolent demonstration on the medal platform after winning the gold and bronze medals in the 200 meters. This was known as the Black Power salute protest. And the International Olympic Committee was so outraged at this ruining of their ritual that they ordered Smith and Carlos out of the country, or else American athletes would not be allowed to take part in the rest of the games.
You'd think that things couldn't get worse after 1968, but they did. in 1972?
Well, 1972 was the great tragedy of the pro-Palestinian Black September terrorists attacking the Israeli athletes in the Olympic Village. I think what's significant about this event from the point of view of the Olympic movement, the Munich massacre, is that the terrorists, they didn't really care one way or the other about the Olympics. What they cared about was an international stage, and by that time it became clear that the Olympics was a mass international event.
Which brings us to today. You have the Olympics in China. Would anybody, anywhere, imagine that this event could be staged without politics?
First of all, you have to understand that this was not a unanimous vote to award the Games to Beijing. It was about 56 to 49. When they were awarded, I think that a lot of people in the Olympic movement tried to convince themselves that, oh, this was going to, you know, help China. It was going to open it up. Because, in fact, that is what happened when the 1988 Games were awarded to Seoul, South Korea, which at the time was a dictatorship. But under pressure from the International Olympic Committee and others, the South Korean military actually stepped down, held democratic elections, and by the time of the Seoul Games in 1988, South Korea was in fact a democracy and has remained so since. I think a lot of members of the International Olympic Committee might have deluded themselves into thinking the same thing would happen with China. But it's a very, very different situation. South Korea was an emerging economy. They needed the help of the outside world. In 2008, China is not an emerging economy. So that was a mistake. And right now you see the International Olympic Movement kind of trying to grin and bear it and just say, well, we're going to go ahead with the games. Please don't punish the athletes for whatever your political beliefs are.
All right. David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Walachinsky is an Olympics historian, and he's author of the complete book of the Summer Olympics.
Coming up, good news and bad news for news and the real meaning of the Second Amendment.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The right to bear arms, that's what the Second Amendment to the Constitution guarantees, right? Maybe. On March 19th, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case that likely will determine an issue that has been settled in the court since 1939, but not in the public policy debate. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor at Slate, and she's been covering the case. Dahlia, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's not litigate this one, but tell me briefly about the D.C. handgun ban that was struck down by an appeals court and which the Supreme Court is now considering.
Well, the ban is widely considered one of the most restrictive in the nation, and it pretty much bans handguns altogether, with some exceptions. The gun ban was struck down as unconstitutional, and then the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a very prestigious and influential court in the nation, went and said, yes, that's right, the gun ban is unconstitutional because the Second Amendment provides a personal right to bear arms. And this was really a shocker. And the Supreme Court really had to look at this issue very, very closely for the first time in 70 years.
Well, for some of our listeners, the shocker will be that this came as a shocker, because we have so often heard the Second Amendment guaranteed right to bear arms that many of us have come to believe that that is a matter of settled law to one degree or another. Not necessarily so, eh?
Well, that's what's really amazing. This is sort of the stealth amendment. The last time the Supreme Court heard a major, major gun case was in 1939. I sort of joke people were wearing fedoras and driving Packards. And what the court pronounced is actually the opposite of what you've just said, and most people believe. The court said, no, it's not a personal right to pack heat. It's a right that's very much constrained by the first half of the Second Amendment, the part that we don't know, that says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So the question really for the courts has been settled. This is a right that goes to militias. If your National Guard wants to assert a Second Amendment right, that's fine. But you as a Joe guy on the street do not have a right that flows from the Second Amendment. And that's the really interesting part, is that the American public has a whole different and, as you suggest, almost antithetical notion of what the law says.
Is it because of lobbying by so-called gun rights organizations that have led us to believe that this is still an open question?
This was very, very much influenced by the gun lobby. And the NRA, you know, it's not an accident that on the side of their building, their national headquarters, they only have the second half of that clause I read to you. Now, I will say one thing that has changed in the last few decades that really made this interesting is that the legal academics who, you know, we all sort of think of pointy-headed guys in their ivory tower, it doesn't matter, but liberal constitutional scholars started to argue very strenuously for the NRA position on the Second Amendment. There should be a strong individual right to bear arms enshrined in the Second Amendment for the same reason that we believe there should be strong individual rights protected by the First and Fourth and Fifth Amendments. And so suddenly the Academy was all hepped up about it. And that's one of the things that really, I think, drove the sea change that we've seen in the last few years.
So if this case is decided in the gun lobby's favor, does that mean that I can get not only a handgun and a machine gun, but that Stinger missile launcher that I've had my eyes on for so long?
You and me both. I don't think so, Bob. I think that the key to this case really is going to be the definition of what is a, quote, reasonable regulation on guns. And even though the court didn't talk about that reasonableness factor very much, it's an important part of this test. So what the court's going to do now is go back and look at, okay, assume that there's a fundamental Second Amendment right, a personal individual right to bear arms. Even notwithstanding that, what would be reasonable regulations? And that's where it's going to get interesting. There's a lot more litigation that is going to come out of this.
As you look at the media coverage of the gun issue as a public policy matter of the last many decades, do you think, you know, we as a group have done a good job explaining the stakes, or have we somehow used a shorthand that obscures the issue?
I think that where we failed is explaining the lay of the land. I think that we've gotten very, very involved in the Brady versus NRA horse race and who's winning, you know, on vote counting and who's winning on fundraising and who is responsible for Al Gore, you know, losing the 2000 election in his home state of Tennessee. That's very, very interesting to the media. But I think the legal question, the constitutional question, you know, here's what the courts have held for decades and this has not wavered. I think that's where we sort of fell asleep at the switch, because it seems to me, as you said, that when you look at the polls, most Americans have no idea what the state of the law was.
All right, Dahlia. As always, thank you very much.
As always, my pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick is a senior editor at Slate.com. The Project for Excellence in Journalism has released its fifth annual State of the News Media report. And the good news is the state of the news is strong. There is an audience. People still want news. Old school, mainstream, shoe leather news, you know, like you get in the newspaper. The catch is we want to find the news where we already live, on our Facebook pages and through links sent by friends over email. So while the state of news audiences is strong, the state of news business, not so much. Still, news seems to be better positioned than entertainment media. According to project director Tom Rosensteel, entertainment is awash with competitors, while the nation's great news outlets still own the field.
Google has not really gone into the news gathering business, nor has AOL or even Yahoo, which has toyed with it a little bit. What they're offering is wire copy from the AP and aggregating the New York Times and the Washington Post. And so blogging, posting comments, and all kinds of other activities are now part of my news consumption. But that discussion still seems to begin with my reading the news of what happened yesterday.
One of the more interesting observations in the report is about how news consumers interact with the news versus the way they did in the mainstream media bad old days. Now, when reading online, people start at a story and dig into a link and maybe from there to another link, layer after layer downward, or maybe wholly away from the original website to begin with.
The general thinking now about a designing of a web page is that the interior page of a website that has a particular story on it should devote 50% of the space on that site to telling me where I can go for other information. Another way that we're seeing this is that even a year ago, a lot of traditional websites only contained the information that their people had produced. It was what they called the walled garden. Even now, today, a year later, that's no longer the case. I can drill down and get to the Washington Post from the New York Times, even though they're direct competitors, because the expectation is that I'm hunting the internet for things, and your website should be a way station, a place that it can help me get to where I want to go. If it were a dead-end street, a cul-de-sac, it would be less useful to me.
All right, let's get to the economics of the news gathering business. Let's start with display advertising, those delicious full-page ads from department stores and supermarkets that used to fill the paper and line the pockets of publishers.
Yes, there is no equivalent of that full-page ad on the internet. The idea that the ad was a kind of content that would draw you to the newspaper doesn't really translate online. I can go directly to Best Buy's website or Circuit City's website at 3 in the morning. I don't have to wait for the Sunday paper and all those wonderful color supplements, which I might have spent 10 or 20 minutes with all by themselves before I even looked at the newspaper itself. And that's only part of the problem that newspapers are having with advertising.
The other part of the problem is the big cash cow of newspapers since time immemorial, and that's the classified ads. But now Craigslist, which is free, has rendered the classified business, you know, almost irrelevant.
It's true. Newspapers used to derive about 40% of their revenue from classifieds. Roughly about half of that classified is now gone away. And there's all kinds of sectors that potentially the news business could have kept, let's say real estate advertising, but the realtors have created their own online classifieds for real estate in a given community. You go to realtor.com and you can look those things up. So those things have decoupled themselves in some ways from news, and that's proving to be devastating.
Isn't an even larger problem consumer behavior itself? They don't click on the banner ads. Given the option to close a full page display ad, they will. Is advertising going to be the means of financing news content in the, you know, even intermediate future?
There's no question that advertising in totality will not be enough. So what else might there be? It could be drilling down and actually making your retail purchases right there in the ads, that an ad becomes not an ad so much as the beginning of a retail transaction.
And what about micropayments, the idea of, you know, paying a penny or two or, you know, 12 for a story that I've clicked on?
I think that the signs are that that is not likely to happen anytime soon, and maybe not at all, at least not that way. I think there's more potential for something along the lines of the cable model. In cable, I pay a subscription fee to CNN and to Fox News and to the Golf Channel and to the Food Channel every month, but I'm not aware of it. It's embedded in my cable access fee that I pay to the cable company. There is a vested interest in the Verizons and the Comcasts of the world having a robust news business because it's such a draw for traffic.
Newspapers have been forced into cost-cutting, retrenchment, closing bureaus, buying out veteran reporters and editors, and depriving themselves of the very resources that they're going to need to maintain an audience to get from here to whatever that intermediate future is.
That's the great dilemma. It's something of a race against time. The company that emerges, I think, is the one that's going to say, we can't be prudent. We have to take a gamble. We're going to not cut this company, and we're not going to trim our news staff, and we're not going to reduce this product down that much, because that ultimately is going to kill the golden goose.
Tom, thank you so much, as always.
My pleasure, Bob. Thanks.
Tom Rosensteel is the director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism. It has just released its fifth annual State of the American News Media report. When ESPN launched in 1979, it offered a patchwork of programs like Australian Rules Football and tape-delayed college sports. Now, ESPN has billion-dollar contracts with major sports leagues to air their games. In fact, it's the 800-pound gorilla in sports media. But success breeds critics, and ESPN has quite a few, ranging from league executives to ad agencies to competing TV networks. Now they've compiled their complaints in a PowerPoint presentation, which has found its way all over the place, including the desk of John Arand, a reporter at the Sports Business Journal. Arand says the big takeaway of the presentation is that when sporting events move from broadcast networks to ESPN, their ratings take a dive.
So the PowerPoint presentation is really a note to the leagues saying, why are you going into bed with ESPN? You should be with us because we provide more viewers and we get better ratings. ESPN's side of the coin is that's a, you know, almost a 1990s way of looking at things. And in 2008, if you're really just taking a look at a health of a league or a health of a network through a three-hour window, you're missing the point, because if you do a deal with ESPN, you also get coverage in ESPN.com, you get coverage in ESPN the magazine, you can get on ESPN radio.
Not to mention feeds of highlights of your games on ESPN mobile.
Exactly. NFL is a good case study of this. ESPN got Monday Night Football, and the ratings for Monday Night Football have been dropping. However, if you add up all the viewers across all their platforms, across all their hours that they devote to NFL coverage, ESPN says it would dwarf what anybody else brings.
One interesting complaint is the swirling conflicts of interest between ESPN, the partner with a sports league, let's just say the NFL, and ESPN, the news network, which covers the sport, warts and all.
This is where ESPN finds itself in a no-win situation. They get constantly criticized by the blogs, by viewers, for going too soft on certain leagues because they're partners with them. And meanwhile, on the other side, they get consistent complaints from the leagues that they are being too hard on them. Internally, ESPN has a very distinct line between the news gathering operation and the actual people that manage their relationships with the leagues. Outside of ESPN, it's harder to tell. For instance, at CBS, 60 Minutes can do a hard-hitting piece on the NFL, and the NFL, they might not like it, but they know that to complain to CBS News and not CBS Sports. At ESPN, it's all just ESPN. And to add to the problem, ESPN has spent the past year or so poaching some of the best reporters in the business from various newspapers and magazines, and those reporters oftentimes report stories that the leagues just really don't like.
I actually want to talk about not ESPN, but the leagues themselves. Some sports are actively trying to dictate the terms of coverage. Can you give me some examples?
Well, online, for example, the NFL only allows each website to use 45 seconds of coverage. Major League Baseball, I think they went up to like a minute and a half. This is the big issue. Baseball in January is getting ready to launch its own network, where they're going to be news gathering, they're going to be doing games. The NFL has its NFL network. And by launching their own networks and by launching their own websites, these sports leagues are becoming media companies in their own rights. And by becoming media companies and owning the content, they're being much more judicious about who can use that content. And we're really seeing a sea change in terms of how the community newspaper or the local newspaper and the local radio station is able to get in and cover these sports and these teams.
Well, this brings us tidily back to ESPN, because as the NFL and Major League Baseball develop these networks of their own, don't they ultimately jeopardize the ESPN, the 800-pound gorilla, and potentially make him irrelevant?
Yes and no. ESPN pays the NFL $1.1 billion a year. The NFL doesn't want to let go of that revenue. If they were to take the games that are on ESPN and put them on the NFL network, there's no way they would be able to bring in enough in terms of ad revenue or license fees from cable operators that would equate to that $1.1 billion that ESPN pays. On the other side of the coin, you do have something like the baseball channel. There's a ton of baseball games out there, many more than the NFL. And I believe that you're going to see increasing amounts of baseball games move to the Major League Baseball channel. But ESPN is trying to guard against that happening. And they're doing deals, such as a deal that they did with the Arena Football League. They own part of the Arena Football League. So they have product, if all these major sports goes away, that they own and they own alone.
And if a star in the Arena Football League, if there is such a thing, should get caught committing a felony, how tough do you expect the coverage to be on SportsCenter that night?
I have zero doubt that they would be very tough on them in SportsCenter. And I know that the news division of ESPN causes a lot of headaches for the other side, the corporate part of ESPN.
Okay, John. Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.
John Arand is a reporter for the Sports Business Journal.
Coming up, a veteran American political reporter trains journalists in a newly political Bhutan.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship, on the web at kauffman.org, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world, the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield with an update. Sirius and XM, the two satellite radio monoliths that make up the entire satellite radio universe, cleared a major hurdle on the way to becoming a single colossus this week. The Justice Department's antitrust division approved the $4.6 billion buyout of XM by Sirius, a merger first proposed in February of 2007. Satellite radio subscribers are now one step closer to hearing Howard Stern, Oprah Winfrey, and Bob Edwards on the same channel. Dare to dream. The Federal Communications Commission has yet to weigh in, but most media watchers expect it to approve the deal, despite critics' objections, including the National Association of Broadcasters, which says the merger will create a monopoly. But beyond FCC approval lies the ultimate question for satellite radio: how to compete with technologies like internet radio and podcasts. And, oh yeah, how to make money doing it.
And now some letters. Mostly positive mail came into our mailbox about our five-year retrospective on our coverage of the war in Iraq. There was a more mixed assessment posted in our comments online. Here's a few of those. Catherine Hoffman of Allentown, Pennsylvania, wrote in to thank us, quote, for an incisive, refreshingly trenchant history and analysis of the professional media's weakness in assessing and reporting the Iraq war, from the misleading and deceptions in the buildup to this sorry five-year mark.
Kay Fitz of Mosier, Oregon, was not impressed. Quote, wow, NPR, for 5 years you've been the spokespiece for the Pentagon, but suddenly you found the courage to report the truth. Is it because you sense a regime change in the White House that might be more supportive of real reporting of the Iraq occupation?
But Kevin Hales of Durham, North Carolina, says we've been too critical. Quote, you should examine what would have happened if during World War II people had held the media, the military, and the U.S. to the same rules of conduct that you insist upon today. Being a self-examining, self-critical society is vital, but holding the U.S. to absurdly imbalanced rules of conduct to the point of self-debilitation is horribly dangerous, not only for us, but for the whole world.
Keep those comments coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org or post them at onthemedia.org. And don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Democracy is on the march in Bhutan, sort of. The tiny Himalayan nation held its first ever parliamentary elections this week, and the Peace and Prosperity Party trounced the rival People's Democratic Party. No one quite knows why. Apparently there wasn't much difference between them. The Bhutanese were ordered to democratize by their king, and there wasn't much enthusiasm for the exercise, at least at first. The journalists also were a little nervous. After all, it was their first election, too. Andrea Bernstein, political director for our producing station, WNYC, was invited to Bhutan to help train reporters unschooled in the sometimes indelicate art of political reporting. She sent us back this postcard.
As the story goes here, the people didn't want democracy. But as National Geographic put it, kings win arguments. Or so newspaper editor Ugin Pajor told us at tea the morning our training began. He said his parents, uneducated farmers, were among the unconvinced.
When we write about the parties accusing each other of bribery, of forcing people to sign up with a party, sometimes I hear my parents talk, oh, we shouldn't have done this.
So that was our task, teaching covering democracy in a society where people didn't really want it.
The basic idea, really, in one sentence, is to give Bhutanese journalists as much exposure and training as possible.
That's Kinley Dorji, the editor-in-chief of Kuncel, Bhutan's first newspaper, the one who brought 50 Bhutanese journalists to this U-shaped conference table to learn the basics. And so we began, me and my training partner, Michael Putzel, former AP White House bureau chief.
Please, those of you who have questions, do not be afraid
to taught the five W's and fairness. We had writing exercises, guest speakers, practiced press conferences. We confronted the problem of teaching political journalism in a non-confrontational society, where the two parties, the DPT and the PDP, downplayed their differences, where people were never taught to state their preferences, where they never had the need to learn what is perhaps the most important rule for journalism. Don't take no for an answer. Then came day four, the day the students were dreading. We piled into a van and took them to the bus station and vegetable market. They were there to practice the art of asking questions of people who they assumed didn't want to answer.
Yes, we're in Paris.
The first interviews seemed to confirm their fears.
Ask him what is important to him.
He doesn't know.
Will he be voting?
But then the reporters approached a woman who was upset because she couldn't get her voting card. The woman had problems with her papers and wanted to vote, but couldn't. Over by a giant pile of green onions, Kesang Dema of Kuncel was speaking to the woman who cleaned the market.
She has six kids. Then the eldest is unemployed. Her husband expired 8 months ago.
Bhutanese election law requires voters to return to their home villages to vote. That sometimes several days' journey, often on foot over very hard roads.
She will go all the way down to south to vote. She has been talking to the bus ticket person. Yeah, basically, she is keen to go and vote.
Suddenly, the students learned another rule of journalism. People don't always react according to their expectations. I learned that again. There in the market.
Mm-hmm. So maybe if you want to do one more and then we'll gather, I'll start walking everybody that way. Okay?
Shring Paling, the Bhutanese broadcasting system, approached a chili vendor standing alone near baskets of bright red and green chilies. She was ready to state her preference in the ballot box. In fact, she was sure. A friend joined her and chimed in. Then five more women, some with children lashed to their backs, gathered around the young man with a notebook. They all had something to say. As we climbed into a van to go back to the training, the students were amazed.
I think all are converted their mind to vote for DPT.
Somehow, under orders from His Majesty the King, the people of Bhutan were becoming engaged. And the journalists were witnessing it, documenting the shift from hesitation to full-throated participation in democracy. On my last day in Bhutan, Tsering Paulden, who'd been a journalist for 5 months and 1 week, hiked with me up to Taksang, one of Bhutan's most famous monasteries. When we arrived more than 9,000 feet up, the guard shook his head, no tourists allowed. Tsering patiently explained, I wasn't a tourist. I was there on an important training mission. Three times, he was told, no. On the fourth time, we were waved in. He didn't take no for an answer. For On the Media, I'm Andrea Bernstein.
This time last year, On the Media played something of an April Fool's joke, an interview about a new sitcom called You Had to Be There, which we described as, quote, a madcap romp through a terrorist training camp. We made the whole thing up, but it was just believable enough that some of you fell for it. And that kernel of truth is what most good practical jokers rely on, including and especially veteran hoaxer Alan Abel. Abel has spent a lifetime conjuring up fictitious characters and causes and turning the joke on the media. Decades ago, he created a fast-talking character named Omar who taught classes on panhandling. The news media ate it up.
Omar's intensive training course takes a week and costs $100. For that, students are taught gimmicks to suit their personalities and locations that Omar handpicks for maximum cash flow.
Aspiring beggars take 5 2-hour classes from this hustler. He says he's launched thousands of careers.
So how do we know who is truly homeless and who is a con man?
To carry out his hoaxes, Abel sometimes enlisted the help of his daughter, Jenny, who grew up with this madness and has preserved it for all to see in the documentary Abel Raises Cain, recently out on DVD. Both father and daughter join me now. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Jenny, welcome to you.
Thank you, Brooke.
Let's start with Alan. Another one of your early hoaxes first got the attention of the press in the late 50s. It was an advocacy group called SENA, the Society for Indecency to Naked Animals. And the actor Buck Henry played SENA spokesman G. Clifford Prout, and you played another SENA executive. And the mission of the group was what?
Well, to clothe all naked animals for the sake of decency, mainly any animal that stands higher than 4 inches or longer than 6 inches. We wanted to put Bermuda shorts on horses, jumpsuits on cats, moo-moos on cows, and a nude horse was a rude horse in our estimation.
Now, you didn't have a larger message here, right? You were just having fun?
No, it was a test against censorship. If we're going to censor books, records, films, why not censor those naked animals out there? How do you explain to a 3-year-old child why Rover the dog is naked and mom and dad aren't? You can't. So he or she grows up with a double standard. They run away from home. They get pregnant. They take up smoking, drugs. And we have to stop that. So that was my message.
Okay. And it quickly gained a number of very serious adherents who didn't realize it was a joke.
Oh, starting with Walter Cronkite. He did a full 7 minutes on the CBS network about 40 years ago, and he's still angry today. I heard this from a friend of Buck Henry's. Walter is still angry after all these years he got fooled by that crazy campaign. He's not mad at Hitler, Mussolini, or Saddam. He's mad at us for fooling him about clothing naked animals.
Now, Jenny, as a kid watching your dad on TV playing these characters, what'd you think he did for a living?
All I really knew of it was that my father was a performer. I wasn't really cognizant of the underlying message, if there was one. I just saw this guy wearing a black hood on television and my mom saying, "Oh, Jennifer, there's Daddy on TV."
That was when he was playing Omar, the teacher of panhandlers.
That's correct, yeah. I was a small child at that point.
You've just been bounced from your job, and you got to get something. You can't stand $100 a week, take home pay $74, $75. You need more than that. You need $200, $300, $400, $500 a week to live. Okay, you're going to get it, because this is what professional panhandling is all about.
When you saw your father on TV wearing that black hood, it terrified you.
He just looked so frightening. And in fact, I found the hood just by itself, I think in my dad's desk drawer, and I immediately leaped away from it. It was a scary revelation or realization, rather, to understand that that, in fact, was my dad underneath that.
Your father gets subsumed so thoroughly into his characters. Did you think he was a different person?
In a sense, yes. And sometimes I still wonder when my dad is falling in and out of character.
When I was in elementary school, I remember the other kids asking me what my dad did for a living. And I would say he's on TV, because I really thought that that was his job. But none of the kids believed me and taunted me for being a liar. I didn't know how to explain to them that he was on TV, but just never as himself. He would appear under different aliases, like Dr. Harrison T. Rogers, Bruce Spencer, or Count von Blitzstein, or Martin Ostreicher, or Rufus Thunderberg, or Martin Swag Jr.
When he's deadpanning, he just spews BS, and you get trapped inside of this weirdness.
Your father is nodding.
But most people don't get the message, Brooke. I don't think hardly anyone saw that SENA, the Society of Clothed Naked Animals, was a satire on censorship.
I don't think so either, which raises the question, why bother?
It's fun. I mean, ideas like euthanasia cruises, when Dr. Kevorkian was hot in the news, it made newspaper stories all over the country. The idea of going out for 3 days from Fort Lauderdale, fun, food, sex, whatever you want. Then the deck is greased, the railing is taken away, and you slide down into Davis Jones's locker for people who have nothing left to live for. Now, I did interview after interview after interview with reporters who wanted to go aboard the Last Supper. That was the name of the ship.
Why a spoof about some bimbo winning the lottery?
Well, this young lady came to me, Lee Trilla. She's a fine actress. And she said, you know, I don't know whether to wake up in the morning, brush my teeth, or take an overdose. I'm so despondent. I go to these cattle calls as an actress. They want me for my body rather than my brains. I need some stardom. How am I going to get it? So I thought about it and thought about it. At that point, the lottery was up to, I think, $35 million, one of the biggest ever back in 1990. I said, why don't you pretend to win the lottery, and you'll be a darling on the front page of newspapers, maybe, if the Giants don't win.
30-year-old Charlie Taylor has probably given her last manicure and facial. The Dobbs Ferry cosmetologist is the lucky winner of last night's $35 million lottery.
There is a woman from Dobbs Ferry, New York, who may be the luckiest person in the state tonight.
The 30-year-old cosmetologist is the single winner of the $35 million lottery jackpot.
It was that Sunday the Giants did not win. Lee made the front page of the New York Post, the Daily News, and all of the other newspapers all over the world, because here she is, a beautiful young lady who is single, who has $35 million. How can you, as an editor in any newspaper, ignore that as a headline? You can't.
You have spent your entire career gulling, fooling, and humiliating the media. What's your opinion of the news?
Well, you're looking for perversions and calamities. Really, you want obscene, offbeat stories. When I was at the 2000 convention, Republicans, all the reporters were there. They were looking for someone to interview. And they're all in caucus. They're all in meetings. There was nobody there except a few pigeons and rabbits and Citizens Against Breastfeeding.
Should women be allowed to breastfeed in public? One of our guests tonight says absolutely not. Jim Rogers is the East Coast spokesman for Citizens Against Breastfeeding. And Leslie Burby is the vice president of ProMom. So, Jim, let's start with you. What's wrong with breastfeeding in the open? Is it too sexy?
I did 200 interviews following that stint there in Philadelphia.
Jenny?
Yes.
You narrate throughout the documentary, you talk about both your mom and dad as a kind of curiosity, even to you, even now. When you look over the totality of your parents' life, how do you see it?
Well, I do believe that my dad, he is an activist in his own weird way. I don't know. I don't want to say that my dad has changed the world, but I do think that he's changed the way people think, and maybe that's more valuable. I'm not sure.
Jenny Abel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Jenny Abel is co-director of the documentary Abel Raises Cain about her father, Alan Abel, a lifetime media hoaxer. Alan, thank you too.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Our position is, after 22,000 respondents have been interviewed using primarily the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Profile, mothers are getting erotic experiences by breastfeeding. Also, we found in a number of cases, and this is only a two-year study, so it's just a warning flag, many youngsters grow up to become, shall we say, antisocial.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, and Nazanin Rafsanjani, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Jason Isaac and Zach Marsh. We also had help from Nadia Zonis and Sasha Evans. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
You're on with Jim Rogers from Citizens Against Women Breastfeeding.
Jim,
yes.
I am a scientist.
Yes.
And to use some very unscientific words, this is a load of crap. God gave us milk in our breasts for a reason.
Heather.
Have a good day.
Why don't you have an aspirin and lie down for a while? Put a cold rag on your forehead. You'll feel better.
Support for On the Media is provided by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC. This is NPR.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.